Welcome to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete Sunshine 96.7 FM. Join us as we celebrate the sparks that ignite, the events that inspire, and the songwriters that create. With your host, Steve Robb.
Spreading joy is what singer-songwriter Ellis Delaney, formerly known as Ellis, does best. With open-hearted modern folk, the beauty of everyday living permeates throughout their new album, Ordinary Love. Even amidst COVID-19, loss, climate change, and gun violence, Ellis finds joy and meaning from family, community, connection, and ordinary life. Ellis Delaney, welcome to Song Creating.
Oh, thank you so much, Steve. I'm so happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. And you're not the first Midwesterner we've had on board. I had a Texas singer. Oh, actually, no, I'm sorry. James was in Denver. So I think you are the first on Central Time. So,
well, I am from Texas. So I feel like
there's
a Texas connection happening right here.
And I'm hearing a little bit of the Texas more than I hear the Minnesota.
Yeah, it does come out. It both happen. I live on 35 apparently.
So tell me a little bit about your transition, or maybe you're growing up from Texas to Minnesota. Musically, obviously, you know, this is a music podcast, but you know, however it affects you in your life.
Oh, sure.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Heck yeah. Well, I grew up in a small town in Texas, and we listened to a lot of country music. I went to a lot of rodeo type events and definitely felt very connected to that music, you know, and so that has always been with me. I feel like that's been a bedrock of my musical, you know, kind of well to draw from. But we moved up to Minnesota when I was about 16, and that was a big adventure. It was to really change things. I had a couple family members who had moved previously up to Minnesota for jobs and loved it, and so kind of threw a line out, and we ended up coming up, and yeah, it was really strange. It was totally different. You know, Steve, I had to get some extra clothing.
I was going to say, winters are very different up there than they are in Texas.
Yeah, but you know, the fun thing was, it really was a musical expanding time for me because of the transition from Texas to Minnesota being so different, and me not having any friends. You know, when I made that move, I really, my aunt had rented a piano, and I really made my new friend the piano, and I spent a lot of time just kind of teaching myself how to play, you know, just really playing around, making stuff up. And, you know, I think that time was really precious because it helped me to kind of sink my teeth even more into the emotional connection that I have with music, and, you know, create songs, which I wasn't really thinking of at the time as, you know, songwriting, but, you know, I thought of it as like, you know, little sketches, little musical sketches I could remember and so come back to.
Is this the period of time? I mean, you moved during high school, which is pretty traumatic in itself. Was this that period of time still in high school when you had first gotten there that you started playing the piano?
Well, you know, actually, I started playing in middle school when I got a keyboard for a birthday present or something. And my mom didn't want me to take piano because she had had a bad experience with nuns and rulers on the knuckles. And so she was like, you know, so I ended up, you know, just playing around, making stuff up. And so, you know, really the first song I wrote was, you know, there was a kind of a traumatic event that had happened, and I needed to work through it. I needed to process it. And so, you know, writing this song really helped me to connect to that something extra.
I want to back up.
Yeah.
I want to back up a little bit. This is your first song that you wrote. Had you been writing poetry or what?
Yeah.
Okay, so you had some poetry background, or we could say some lyric writing background, but then you were starting to add music. And about what age were you when this occurred?
I was about 12, maybe 11. And I was, you know, creating ditties on the piano. So I had been creating ditties. I had been writing. I mean, you know, I'm sure it was, now I can't really remember exactly, but I'm sure it was, you know, part of writing in school, you know, how they do the poetry lesson and whatever. Sure. And so, you know, but I always found words to be really helpful and interesting. And then I've always found the country songs that I grew up listening to, they were like family. I mean, I felt like, you know, some of the Dolly Parton, the you know, Garth Brooks, you know, there are all these people, Loretta Lynn, all these people that were surrounding me in the music world that felt like family. And so for me, it felt very natural to, you know, have a conversation with myself, with my higher, you know, with something greater than myself, you know, just to try and work through whatever this, you know, this thing I couldn't figure out how to work through and otherwise. And so, yeah, and it just sort of, I didn't even think of it as writing a song as much as just trying to connect.
Express yourself.
Yeah.
And yeah, I wonder how many songwriters actually start out in at about that age testing things and figuring things out and throwing things away. And I remember, I think my first song was, I was probably 12, and it's horrible. And I honestly still remember it. I mean, it was just, at least little snippets of it. And of course, it's just horrible and not expressive at all because, you know, I was a knucklehead 12-year-old boy. I didn't know how to express myself, but I knew how to strum an electric guitar. So I think our experiences were probably a little bit different.
Yeah. Oh, well, for sure. I mean, you know, if I had had somebody in the house that was like, you know, doing, my dad played acoustic guitar in the church. My mom and my dad were separated when I was really young. And so I would spend some time with him and some time with her. And, you know, when I was with him at church, you know, it always seemed like at some point I would ask him to help, you know, to learn how to play, but it didn't like ever happen, but I would watch him play, you know, but so I didn't actually make the connection that I could play guitar myself, that, you know, and I don't know if it's the gender thing, you know, if it's like girls and boys, what you're allowed to do or not allowed to do. I don't know. It was like, but for whatever reason, you know, when I came up to Minnesota and eventually joined I had to join a rock band playing keyboard before I could learn how to play guitar. And then once I realized, right? Oh my gosh, guitar is so much easier to carry around.
Yeah, it is.
Oh.
Are you in the Twin City area?
Yes, absolutely. I'm in Minneapolis.
Is that where you moved to from Texas as well?
We moved to the suburbs of Minneapolis, yep, to Bloomington. And then, you know, I got the heck out of the suburbs into the city because that's what I really like.
So it wasn't just a transition from Texas to Minneapolis, but it sounds like it's a transition from the sticks, which I guess you alluded to,
yep,
to the city, but also from country to... I mean, Minneapolis has a huge musical community of, and I think what we know more about Minneapolis is more its rock scene than country and jazz, and so that must have been a real transition right there too.
Oh yeah, it was a real musical shift that happened, you know, because the people around me were listening to, you know, REM and, you know, Nirvana and, you know, all the different, you know, the bands that were out in the 90s. I guess it would be the 90s.
There's a lot of R&B in Minneapolis,
oh, yeah,
too, I think. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
More so than
Prince.
In Texas.
Prince.
Oh, right. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where did Ellis Delaney come from, the singer-songwriter musician?
Well, you know, so here's the thing. So I made my piano my best friend, right? And so here I am in the band room in Bloomington, you know, not really knowing anybody and just kind of playing in the band room in the mornings before school started. And I would be playing these songs that I had written and, you know, I was singing and I was, you know, people would hang out listening behind I would find them and I'd be like, ah, you know, and they're, that is really good. I really like that. You should be in the talent show, you know? And so it's, oh, okay, I'll try it for the, I'll be in the talent show. And so I played in the talent show. And then this this older junior, senior, I think he was a junior at the time, you know, he played a percussion in our band. And he said, "Oh, I hear you're a singer and piano player. Our piano player and singer just quit in our band that we've got, you know, my older brother's band." And his band was, you know, three other members in college and then him, because he was the brother of the bass player who was going to St. Olaf College. And anyway, so it was just one of those things where I went and tried out, you know, for their band. And it was so great because I was playing my music, which is, you know, all over the place, just using my ear and the feel and memory, you know, memorizing the different pieces that I put together. And, you know, and so they hired me on the spot. And then when I got to the first rehearsal, Steve, they asked me, "Okay, so then you play C and then you go to G and then you know, and I looked at him and I was like, "Oh no, what you're talking about, you'll have to show me." And so that was the only learning curve, was having to, you know, actually learn those chords and, you know, be able to put them together. But it was so much fun. And I was the backup singer. I was the pianist in the background, and I loved that. And there was something about when they asked me to step up and sing a cover for the band, and they were playing shows in bars. They were playing, my first show was at a college, you know, a festival at Gustavus College, Earth Day Festival, you know, and I'm playing to all these college kids, you know, here as a sophomore and in high school. And I just felt more at home than I have ever felt. You know, it was amazing when I got out in front of the band and sang that cover song. I was just blown away by how it felt like, you know, I just felt that yesness, you know, you know, and I felt connected to the people in the audience, and they didn't seem all of a sudden they didn't seem like college kids. They just seemed like, you know, friends. I mean, it just was really interesting to me how suddenly I was like, "Oh yeah, I'm doing this for the rest of my life. This is what I'm doing."
It sounds like you remember that moment pretty clearly.
I do. Yeah.
So you were still in high school at this time.
Yes.
And okay, so did that, I mean, was there a point, did you come home and tell your parents after that show, "Yeah, I want to become a rock and roll musician, and you can't stop me"?
Well, you know, I can't remember exactly. My mom and I were, you know, my mom was still single, and we were, you know, in a two-bedroom apartment, you know, and she was pretty much just like holding on to her hat as a single parent, you know. So I think she was just so happy that I was finding friends, and these friends were pretty good, like pretty wholesome. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. these kids were pretty responsible, and even though we were playing in bars and stuff, everything that we were doing was, you know, really just about the music, and it was pretty clean otherwise, you know, and so my mom felt that, and so did the other parents, and the, you know, and she just really rolled with it, Steve. I think she felt the yesness of it from me. You know, I don't know. I was very lucky to have her support and her willingness to give me the leash rein. You know, the I don't know, that's not quite the right word. I don't, you know, I have a daughter. Hopefully I'm not putting her on a leash.
Well, I think that there's you know, there are the rock bands that, you know, obviously are just, you know, the boys want to meet girls, you know, this and that. But these are like team efforts for kids who may not be into sports. And, you know, if you make the analogy, you've got different positions in sports, you've got different instruments in a band, and you really put it all together. And it sounds like that's what you guys found, is that team.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was amazing. I mean, it was amazing to go into the studio, you know, to experience the studio, and you know, as a senior in high school or whatever, I think we made our first, you know, EP kind of thing, and it was just amazing, you know, how much I fell in love. I just kept even more and more and more. I just got more and more affirmation that this is the thing that I'm called to do, and I can do that is of service, that is something that is valuable, that people appreciate. Like, because I kept getting not only internal, yes, you know, kind of feels, but also people would tell me, you know, how much the show or the song that I, you know, I started bringing songs to that band. And then, you know, I got a lot of feedback.
You're getting validation. I mean, we can never have enough of that. So right. you were starting to, the band was playing your own music, your own songs?
Yep. And there were some, like, there was some pushback in that band. And then there was an internal breakup where, you know, the lead singer and the bass player ended up splitting up. And then, so the band kind of fell apart.
I'm shocked.
Right. It's like, but in the meantime, I had started going to St. Olaf College, primarily because I really loved the composition instructor, but also because the bass player could give me rides to rehearsals in the Twin Cities. So it was like there was and then there was good financial aid, like all the things came together. But but during that time when and it was called The Unfinished, the band that I was in, and when The Unfinished kind of fell apart, this other band was starting and they needed a lead singer and they needed songs. And so, you know, I kind of jumped in there. They had been asking me to come and to rehearsal and just to try it out. And so I did. And I just fell in love with this group of nerdy, wonderful kids who were just totally into complicated yet, you know, cool, vibey, you know, kind of music. And it ended up being like a pop, funk, folk, like, you know, party, meaningful party band, you know, where we would have songs that were really just like whatever songs and then songs that were about deep things. And so, it was really great because it was sort of like I transitioned pretty easily then from being the backup singer, being sometimes in the front, to being the full-time front singer, primary songwriter. We did do covers too. Like, I mean, we did, like, you know, Sir Duke, you know, Stevie Wonder. We did, because we had a trumpet, sax, mandolin, violin, the players that could do both those instruments. And so, you know, sometimes we'd have the trumpet and sax together. Sometimes we would have the mandolin and violin together. But you know, it was always like, you know, we could do a lot of tunes really well. And, you know, so we did funky things. We did, Paul Simon, you know, just whatever, but we would intermix our songs, you know, so it was a way to really help the audience feel like they were at a party, you know, and our songs were, you know, hooky and fun and upbeat and danceable too. So, I mean, you know, it's like we got away with it.
You had some good songs. That does help. All right. So take me further now. Did you continue in the music? Did you make this a career at that point?
It's interesting because at that point, so I had my sophomore year. I think it was my sophomore year. I had so many extra songs that didn't fit the band that I was in, Bobby Llama, and so I started on the side, you know, kind of wondering, well, maybe I should, you know, maybe I should put together a solo record or do something solo. And it was around that time that I was working with a sound company. And the sound company, the head of the sound company, you know, really like hammered home that I should not go out and perform unless I'm absolutely polished, you know, unless I've absolutely got it, you know, down. And it's so funny because, you know, he told me that and I remember feeling that. And then with the band, we were working really hard to be polished. But at that point, somebody dragged me to an Ani DiFranco concert. And I couldn't even believe how personable and normal she was in terms of, like, her music was really fantastic, but she wasn't perfect. Like, she was imperfectly perfect. Like, she forgot words. She forgot, you know what I mean? There were some moments in the show, and it didn't make the show worse. It made the show better, you know, because I was as an audience member, I was connecting more to the humanity, to the shared experience. Like, I felt even more like, you know, like if you think about it as a family, you know, like we're all, I felt more in the group, in the circle of family, you know.
And it sounds like the fact that she was comfortable making those mistakes in front of you all meant that you all were family to her, and that was okay.
Yeah.
I wonder if that may have been. Huh.
Yeah. Well, and then it informed me. It was like, oh, I don't have to be perfect. Like, and so it was a real gift. That night was an incredible gift because it really showed me that you could still be amazing. You could still really move people. And it doesn't mean that you got every note perfect or did everything, every word perfect, you know, and because it was beside the point. And something about that really resonated. And so then I did this open mic. And I mean, Steve, it really happened this way. It's like, I went and I did this open mic at the Hard Times Cafe in Minneapolis, and they kept asking for more songs from me. And I thought, you know, isn't this an open mic? Like, shouldn't I be getting off the stage? Like, you know what I mean? Like, and they were like, play another one, play another one. And so I like ended up playing all my song after song after song. And then they made this award for me. And actually I still have it. I have it up on my wall, but it's this little, you know, award. It's the Hard Times Cafe Award. Isn't that the sweetest? And so like,
that's great.
So I got this award, you know, for, and I couldn't even believe it. I was like, oh my God. So it just, it felt to me like, you know, I was being supported not only in being a band front person, but also as a songwriter, as a performer in my own right. I mean, I was so goofy and weird and, you know, like I would laugh and then people loved my laugh and I felt like it made me laugh even more and they laughed even more. And I felt, you know, it's like really interesting to find that, surprisingly you're funny, you know, and it was just, it just felt like a welcome place, the stage, you know, and audiences felt like friends. And so I just kept.
How can you walk away from that?
Yeah. So I made a record, and then back then people bought CDs. And so my solo record, I sold 1,000 copies during lunch at St. Olaf College. You know, that told me.
This is Ellis Delaney in the making. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yes, that does. That says a lot right there. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Wow. So, okay. So now you're still in college. You're writing all your own music and you transition now from the writing the pop, or could you say your music was still poppy, but just without all of the instrumentation, or were you starting to transition into a more of a folk feel?
I really didn't even think of it as folk, Steve. I mean, I didn't even like have that in my brain. I wasn't a part of the folk community even really, except, you know, if you count Ani as a part of that, or maybe also, yeah, I guess I was, somebody invited me to go to the Winnipeg Folk Festival. I had gone there and seen some people like Katie Curtis and a few other folks, you know, mm-hmm. who I just really resonated with their music and thought, wow, this is amazing. This is what I could be doing with my music, you know? And so in that way, I saw myself mirrored back, you know, like, oh yeah, that's what I'm trying to do. You know, that's what I am doing essentially. I just made a record, you know, that was some acoustic songs, but I got my band members to come in and sing a little bit with me or play along with me, but it was more low key. And so I guess contemporary folk was sort of the space I landed in, but it was really just, to me, it was a place to kind of capture my songs and then, you know, the songs that the band didn't necessarily want to take on because they were, they weren't danceable or, you know, there's different, they wanted to pick and choose the ones to make, you know, to llamify.
Yeah, it's kind of too bad that we have to categorize things so much, but I guess it helps in a way, but it also hinders in a way because then it kind of locks you in a little bit to a certain sound somewhat. But yeah, independent acoustic, acoustic. Yeah, I know.
Singer songwriter, you know, like I mean, it's just I don't know. It's like wait, but sure, you know, poet with music, poet melody, poet. Mm. I don't know, like you know. Part comedian, part, you know, you know, so.
How old is your daughter now?
She's now 12. So she's at that place where she's, you know, she's a songwriter too, but she doesn't know it yet. She kind of does. I mean, she's kind of been writing stuff, but like, I think she's, you know, it's hard having a songwriting parent, you know, I think in some ways. In some ways it's awesome, you know, because there's an example of how you do it, which is it's messy. Yeah. It's not all like you all of a sudden, you know, have a great song. You have to, as you know, work at it sometimes. Sometimes you get lucky, but she's been taking Suzuki piano, but what she really loves to do is write. She loves words and she loves stories and she loves characters. And so I see her, really, you know, growing in that way, even more. And so she's definitely, finding her way. I mean, she's going to be going to the song school this year as a student. She's been going every single year because we teach, my wife and I, we teach at the Rocky Mountain Song School every summer. And so she's going to be there this year as a student. So,
So your wife's a songwriter as well then?
Well, she is a marriage and family therapist.
Okay.
Which is, you know, essentially...
Which you need at a songwriter school.
Well, and the thing is, she worked alongside of me for a long time as my booking agent, as my manager, you know, as like, you know, the person who was, you know, kind of my project person, my head, you know, and also my vocal coach. I mean, in studio, she can really tell when something isn't emotionally centered, you know, if it's off, if I'm thinking of something else, it's almost like you can hear it, you know. And so she's been really valuable to say, Ellis, that line, it sounds really musical, but it's doesn't, I don't feel it. Can you do it in a way that's not performing? Can you just, you know what I mean? And it's like,
yeah,
oh, okay. You know, cause you need that outside of you. If you can, if you're lucky enough to have somebody who knows what you're aiming for. And, I mean, I think her being a therapist is, she's just emotionally intelligent, you know, and I think having someone in your life who's emotionally intelligent as a songwriter helps to really, you know, focus the writing. And so she and I have done a lot of co-writing together, and she's, you know, been co-writing from the side for a long time. You know, hey, I liked it better the other way, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, what'd you do to that my favorite part, you know? Why'd you take that out, you know, and that kind of thing.
I think it's really important to have somebody throwing that back at you, because it's always good to have another opinion, a third party opinion. And I wondered if your daughter might be one of those opinions at times as well.
Oh gosh, yes. She
definitely... they always have lots of opinion, but
yeah, actually when I'm writing, I mean, she'll totally come in and be like, you know, hey mama, you know, like, can you, I think that, you know, really you should be, you know, and she's got her own take, you know, and sometimes it's like, it's so powerful. The other take that she has, I'm like, you know what? I think that might be a song you need to write. You know, sometimes I think, oh, yeah, it might be a different song. I have to work on that, you know.
So your subject matter, and there's a lot of subject matters of songwriters, are human elements, you know, relationships. Does your wife help you in... sometimes we have to sort of analyze, if we're writing in a third person, we have to analyze what that person's going through. Like, as I said, we're writing fictional songs as opposed to nonfiction, you know, about ourselves. Does she help you, or does she help you to kind of shape that narrative that you might be making up as you're writing?
Yeah, I would say,
you know,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the key is, you know, is it authentic? Is it true? Does it feel true? Even if it's not technically true, you know, are you feeling the truth in it? You know, and you know, will someone else who is living that truth feel that as their truth, you know, too?
Yeah.
And I think that is the whole thing. You know, it's, can I feel the humanity and the connection in all of the things that I've experienced in, you know, and draw from that and put it into an imagined scenario that I haven't maybe experienced exactly, but I can put to words you know, something that, you know, maybe, an, you know, something that I read in an article I felt moved by, or, you know what I mean? Like, it, you know, and definitely Terry is huge in the, she's the barometer, so to speak, you know, the, so, hey, you're leaning towards cool. I do that a lot. I lean towards cool. Oh, but it sounds so cool. It's like, yeah, but what does it mean? How do you, what, you know? And so, yeah. And so I
wonder if there's a, I wonder if there's an empathy meter. And when you put songwriters together in a room, does that empathy meter just go off the tracks because of, so, there's so much of that that you really have to practice, you know, to get that. I'm guilty of writing sad songs and having to make them, and I'm thankful I have to make them all up. So Ellis, let's talk about your song, Not Everyone Fits. You've got an honest story about this one, the background. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I've always thought of myself as, you know, I describe it, you know, as I'm just in the middle. I'm not, you know, I'm like, I embrace my masculinity and I embrace my femininity, and I'm just in the, you know, it's like, I'd rather just, you know, walk the line, so to speak. And this is before I even knew what non-binary was, or, you know, that in the whole they, them is still, you know, it's becoming way more familiar now, but, you know, it was still kind of new, you know, in a way, even just last year, you know, it still felt mm-hmm. like a little bit less familiar. And so, I don't know, I just kind of was like, so I'm Carrie, I'm not quite woman. I'm womanish.
Okay.
You know, and Carrie was like, that's cool. You know, we're expanding the, you know, it doesn't have, you don't have to exactly fit exactly into this container, you know, of gender. It's just more of a way to advertise this group of people coming together to write, you know, and just to kind of have an angle around it, you know, because, you know, all the people that are a part of it have some identity with female, you know, and so. It's like, okay, that's great. You know, as long as you understand that there's a, you know, it's just, there's, I'm a little stretchy in that area, you know? So, and so, this song came from, this prompt, Prom Dress, one week. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, I have to write a song based on the prompt, Prom Dress, you know? And I went to Terry and I said, Terry, I need help. I need a co-writing partner for this song, because all I want to say is I'm not going to wear that damn prom dress. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's like, in middle school, I went to the middle school prom and but I would not do it in high school. I was like, there's no way I'm just not doing it, because it's all so fancy. And I just told myself it was because I was too fancy and I just didn't want to be fancy and whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, really it's, you know, I, and also being queer, you know, realized my, you know, junior, maybe senior year of high school that, you know, I was really, I'm, you know, interested in women, and I'm just not, that's not my, I'm not, you know, as I was, it's very heterosexual. The proms in general have been, you know, very gendered and very particular about, you know, how you're supposed to present, and you can't just go with friends. Well, nowadays you can. I think nowadays mm-hmm. kids are just going with each other, and it's not about like having to have a date, you know, and have it be something more
right.
dramatic. And that's awesome. I mean, it's so much less
yeah.
pressure for everybody. But anyway, so my wife was like, yeah, you know, actually, you know, and I think it was actually my daughter, Ruby, who came up with this Not Everyone Fits, you know, like this idea that people don't fit into the, you know, cause we were talking about boxes and how every, you know, it's like humanity, we're limited by our language. We're limited by what we even know, you know, realities, you know, so it's like how we describe things makes the difference in how we see things. So it's like, you know, there are all these ideas that we have about things, but the way things really are is much more fluid, is much more, you know, it's like, you know, the universe is really big. There's so much going on we don't get. And so, you know, it's like, how come we put ourselves in such a narrow space often, you know? And so that's what we were talking about as a family. And I think, you know, something came up and Ruby was like, no, yeah, not everybody fits in that space, you know? And so like, you should be talking about how, you know, you can be yourself and how you don't have to be like everybody else. And, you know, and so then I was like, not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress was the line that I came up with. And I was like, ooh, that's good. You know, it's like, not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress, you know? And then, so we started, Terry and I started to really get into work about, you know, how, and then, you know, it's this idea of, you might not understand if you find it easy to choose a restroom without making someone angry. You know, it's like, I have not recently, I think things are, you know, definitely, expanding a little bit, but, you know, in the past, I mean, I had a lot of experiences where I'd go into a restroom and, women would see me and, or would come in and see me in the restroom and then leave and then come back. Cause they went to look at the sign to make sure they were in the right room. And I'd be like, oh, I'm belonging here. Cause I'd always dress really like in masculine clothes. I just not trying to be a man, but just trying to be myself, you know, trying to be less. I'd like to, you know, trying to be plain, trying to just be in the middle. And
yeah.
And so, you know, it's like oftentimes I'd be mistaken for a guy and, or a young guy or whatever. And so, anyway, I would try and reassure the women, you know, going in, but I've been very lucky. There haven't been a lot of, you know, angry people that I was, you know, but it flusters people, you know, when they come into a restroom and see somebody who they think might not, you know, belong there for safety reasons. I mean, I feel like that totally get it. You know, and so I always try and help reassure, but, I've talked to other women who don't fit, you know, queer women who haven't fit the binary scenario, like don't necessarily fit, and who have had the same experience, and so I knew that that was a line that, you know, a lot of people would relate to.
I love the sentiment of what you've written about here, and I think the play on words is terrific. If you call that a play on words, it's great. It really works. I have to ask, who came up with the word neurodivergent?
I did, and it was so funny because when I, you know, because we've been talking a lot about neurodivergence in our household too, because Terry does, you know, also work with trauma, and you know, she works with families, and so
it does sound like a word that you might get from a counselor type thing. Could you define it for us? I mean, I think we have a general sense, but.
Neurodiversity. I mean, it's somebody who doesn't think in a way that is the way that our society has deemed to be the normal way to be, you know, so like someone who processes in a different way or who socially has a different beat, you know, or you know, even someone who maybe isn't as skilled at, you know, organization, but is really skilled at creativity or, you know, thinking outside of the box. I mean, just thinking about myself here, Steve, you know, so I was just like, well, that was really actually hitting the mark over here. But, you know, just like thinking about how we talk about that a lot in our household too, because, you know, officially I'm ADHD also. And so, I mean, that's one, it's not neurotypical is the way that is being, you know, but also just talking with our daughter too about, you know, friends that she's had who have been on the autism spectrum, you know, and just thinking about like how really the only reason why we have neurodivergence is because we have a neuronormal, like we have, you know, this area of
expectations,
you know, with expectations that we function in a certain way or that we do things in a certain way. And when you're outside of that, how else do you describe it but not that? You know what I mean? Right. Like, and so so it just was neurodiversity. I was really excited when I was like, you know, when I got that word neurodivergence in there, you know, it's like, because it to me, it's a way of respectfully talking about everyone who feels outside of the expected norm, the neuronormal.
So
the thing that I would mention with my daughter is that it has been amazing for us to be in a school system, for her to be in a school system where there is support for all the kids that are there and all the identities that they have. So there are kids that are non-binary who are you know, asking for they, them pronouns and are being respected in that. And so my daughter has been, you know, like really excited and supportive of those folks. And we even have a kiddo down the street who now is non-binary and going by they, them. And, you know, Steve, I found myself like, you know, and kids that also, you know, are gendered male, but like feel like there's a gendered male who feels female and who is trying to figure that out. And the support that is there for these kiddos, it's so exciting because I am seeing these kiddos and they are truly expressing themselves. Like they're just being themselves. Like they're just kids. They're just trying to figure out how to be themselves. And so the more space there is for them to figure that out. And my daughter tried for a minute. She was like, am I like non-binary? Am I, you know, and then she's like, no, I'm a girl, you know? And so it's like, okay, you know? But you know, the thing is like, I have been calling myself on the fence for so long. You know, I'm just in the middle. I'm just, you know, I'm a mannish woman. I'm a womanish man. You know what I mean? Like just trying to figure out. And I remember saying at a show recently, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, if I were an elementary school and having the kind of support system that my daughter is having, you know, and the experience that she's having with, you know, having so much support around being who you are, you know, I'd be non-binary. And then it was sort of like, maybe it's never too late to just be who you are. And so, you know, it's really, that's the best way to describe myself as non-binary, but you know, it's really like, just, it's just another box really. So I don't feel like it's something that I have to, you know, it's like, you know, it feels like the box is bigger, I guess I should say, Steve, like it's a bigger, you know, umbrella to say, you know, I can embrace all of who I am and not have to kind of continually say, oh yeah, I'm a mannish woman, or you know what I mean? It's just like, it's just be like, oh yeah, non-binary, boom.
Right. You know, I ordinarily don't bring up sexuality in the podcast because it hasn't come up, but obviously the subject of your song, you know, it does touch on that. And it'd be nice if it just wasn't even a topic. You know, it's I think our town is similar to yours, the demographic, I suppose, or at least, you know, again, we're in Massachusetts, we're, you know, very liberal, and I guess parts of Minnesota are the same way. Do you still have friends in Texas that you correspond with? And how is that?
Yeah,
that's a little different scene down there.
It's a little different scene down there for sure. It's trickier. And I think, you know, I feel for the kids and the families who have kids who are struggling. You know, I actually just did a workshop with some kids in another state that's very conservative over the internet. We did a Zoom thing where I was writing songs with their, you know, with the middle school there. And there was a kid who was identifying as non-binary, but they had to, like, the teacher told me she's not allowed to, like, discuss with this kid the struggle, even though she's seeing it every day that this kid is coming in, you know, just struggling and trying to figure, you know. And so finally, she's not allowed to talk about it unless the kid brings up to her that this is what they want. And you know, and finally, by the end of the week of working with me and the kids, I think just having somebody there who was going by they, them, or they, she, or, you know, whatever, because at the time I was they, she. I mean, yeah, it sounds you know, it's a part of the process, I think, with this new understanding and the way that we're starting to, in the queer community, especially, you know, just understand gender. You know, it's like all about words and how do you identify something fully, you know? And I think so. I'm really feeling, you know, happy that my confusion around the matter isn't just mine. That there are people talking about this. You know, that there is such a thing as not having to be pinned down. You know, necessarily. They them fits the best for me, I think, right now. But you know, this particular kiddo was really struggling, and I think, you know, just having somebody, I make up that, you know, just having somebody in the space, even when we didn't talk about it at all, you know, helped this kiddo be courageous enough to go to the teacher and say, I want to be known as they, them, you know, I'm actually non-binary and I'm trying to figure that out. And so then the teacher was able to say, oh my gosh, of course I will, you know, we will honor that and support you in that. And, you know, and unfortunately there are some school systems that are not allowing a teacher to even do that. Like, right. It aren't allowing a teacher to even support a kid who's trying to figure it out. But reaffirming to them that they need to fit into he or she, or they need to, you know, stop this craziness,
yeah.
You know, which is, you know, it results in kids not feeling valuable and not feeling seen. And, you know, it can cause a lot of mental health issues and potentially suicides.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, that's what's breaking my heart is that, you know, it's like, that's what we know about queer kids. You know, sexuality isn't tied to gender either. I mean, it's a whole other thing, you know, and it's only because we do so much, I think, to make men and women men and women. You know what I mean? Like, I just think there's men don't have to be all tough, and men cry, and men, you know, like, men cook. You know what I mean? And like, it's like, and women, you know, play a hell of a game of baseball, you know what I mean? And fix cars. And you know what I mean? It's like, I don't know. I hope we're evolving. And I hope that some of the pushback that's happening right now is just, you know, the, you know, one step back, you know, with the two steps forward.
I want to hear about your this teaching that you did, or the workshop that you held with these kids, and other workshops that you do, and what's your process with those? Are they songwriting workshops, or are they?
Yeah,
they are. And these kids are in what age?
Yeah, middle school.
Middle school kids and songwriting.
Yes, these are sixth. Wow. Yeah, sixth graders. This is primarily sixth graders.
Wow. I would have loved to have had that opportunity to express myself that
way. Right?
Whoever, you know, it's just, I never would have thought about it. So what's, is there a general process that you go through with them?
Well, you know, I've been really inspired by a couple of songwriters that I have known and worked with and love. Paul Reisler works with Kid Pan Alley, and he's just like a master at going into elementary schools and middle schools and helping kids in classes write a song together as a class, you know? And so I've done some mentoring with him, and also Steve Seskin, who wrote Don't Laugh at Me with another songwriter that has been, was such a popular song, but then also became a school curriculum, and they've got the Don't Laugh at Me kind of songwriting piece too. So he's done some songwriting with kids in classes, and I've talked to him a lot about it. And so really, you know, kind of drawing from those experiences, you know, talking and witnessing songwriting in the classroom, I basically am using my songwriting skills to help guide the process of writing a song together as a class, which is, you know, I provide the chordal structures, but I give them choices, and then they choose as a class. And then I provide, you know, the kind of in general, like, final decisions. But like, ultimately what I do is kind of like really allow them to give ideas. And we figure out the topic first, you know, what we're going to talk about. But then we start talking about what, you know, what do we want to say about that topic, and what we feel about that topic. And, you know, do we have experiences that we've had that remind us of that topic? And then we, you know, lots of input, lots of words, lots of ideas. And then from those ideas, we create, you know, verses, or we create a chorus, and we realize, oh yeah, that chorus, that actually says a lot. So what do we say to help that chorus, you know, feel more, even more true? You know, how do we support that chorus? You know what I mean? And, yeah. And so then before you know it, it's like the experiential teaches kids what are verses, what's a chorus, mm-hmm. You know, the experiential teaches the kids like, oh, this is a puzzle game, you know, this mm-hmm. is like trying to figure out, you know. And with this particular class, they are learning ukulele. And so we did it all on ukulele.
That's great.
Yeah. And so I wrote five different, you know, songs with five different classes, you know, in the same process of just really pulling from the kiddos and, you know, getting them to vote ultimately. And, you know, and,
it sounds
kind of
like
just trusting.
It sounds like there's a little bit of a democratic process education
Truly.
In here as well. They've got it's almost yeah. like they're putting a bill together in Congress, and they've got all these little elements, and then they have to vote. And so there's even beyond the music, they're learning a lot. That sounds like
oh, yeah.
a great opportunity.
And you know, I should say, Steve, too, that like not everyone fits. I mean, part of the it's not all about the gender, you know. I just want to just express that it's all, you know, it's about like people who aren't, you know, the normal body size, you know, people who don't yeah. fit this, you know, the stereotypical space that we kind of present in our society as the ideal of what we want to be and do. And it just feels like we need more encouragement out there to be our clunky human selves, and, you know, to trust that can be very bright, you yeah. know, that it's not about having to be a certain way.
Well, I think we did speak a lot about the gender and sexuality nature of the song, but you really do address a lot of that in mm-hmm. this with different sizes of clothes and also what you believe, which, you know, you could reference, you know, religions and all kinds of things.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think it's terrific, and it just really covers a lot of bases, and it's a beautiful song, and it's beautifully sung by you as well. It's great.
Oh, thank you. Thank
so,
you, Steve.
Thank you so much. We are going to end with listening to Ellis Delaney, who wrote the song. Actually, I see Terry Delaney is a co-write. Okay.
Yes.
So Ellis Delaney and Terry Delaney, Not Everyone Fits. Thanks very much. I look forward to seeing you again on stage or on video or wherever it might be.
Likewise. Thank you so much, okay. Steve. It's been a joy.
Every day we have to choose one of two boxes. Even before we're born, they ask pink or blue. What side of the store do you shop on? What salon or barber? Will they say your name and the pronouns you use? Oh, yeah. Oh, not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress. Oh, not everyone has the right box to check that makes sense. You might not understand if you find it easy to choose a restroom without making someone angry. What if one size fits all doesn't fit you at all? Everything is made for bodies smaller than you. Your doctor cries out, exercise and eat less, tying all your troubles to the weight you could lose. Oh yeah. Oh, not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress. Oh, not everyone is a model on a magazine rack. You might not understand if you find it easy to try on any look or style that makes you feel fancy. What if the way you are is not the right way to be? Who you love or where you live or what you believe. You're either not enough or too much. The pressure is intense when the way you think and talk is neurodivergent. Oh, oh, not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress. Oh, not everyone has the right box to check that and make sense. Could we make room for everyone to belong? 'Cause aren't we all better off being true to who we are? Oh, not everyone fits. Ooh, not everyone fits. Not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress. Not everyone fits. Ooh, not everyone fits. Oh, not everyone fits into a tux or a prom dress.
Thanks for listening to Song Creating on Radio St. Pete, Sunshine 96.7 FM. If you like what you hear, you can find Song Creating on your favorite podcast app or at songcreating.com. To check out my own music, go to steverobb.com. And until next time, keep a song in your head and music in your heart. Thanks for listening.